live from the Third Coast. It is our time to focus on where genealogy and spirit connect, a time to focus on our connection with ourselves and our past. Here's your host, Susan E. King.
Hello, everybody. Another happy Tuesday. It's sunshiny, a little bit cold down here on the Third Coast, but we're glad to be back. I think we're over all of our technical problems for the year. At least I hope so. In any event, I really enjoyed my show last week with Valencia King Nelson and the Afrogenius Group, and what a wonderful project they are doing. And today we're going to talk a little bit about some of the skeleton issues that some of us may have in our closet. And, you know, when we're doing genealogy and when we're starting our families, we unfortunately always have either a black sheep or something that happened in our family where there are some, things that don't add up and stories that don't add up, and usually one can find when those stories don't add up that there's something criminal about the past and the shady past of some of our relatives. So we all have them. I know I have them. My guest has some, which brought him to write probably one of the first books on genealogy and criminal history, and that's the Jews of Sing Sing. And Ron Ahrens is joining me again to talk a little bit about his new book called Wanted, U.S. Criminal Records. It's probably one of the first and most complete resource, 38 pages, of how to do criminal research, genealogy research in the United States. So it should be an interesting hour. Stay with us. We will take your calls towards the end of the show, and I'll give out that number if you might want to call and ask any questions, and that is 888-815-9756. Welcome back, Ron. It's been a while since June.
Thanks, Susan. I have to interrupt and correct you. It's not 38 pages. It's 388 pages.
Well, you know, my brain was going faster than my mouth. Ha! That happens occasionally.
It's a little bit bigger than 38 pages.
There you go. I meant 388 pages. But I appreciate the correction. You know, that happens. We talked about this over the when we were talking the other day about senior moments or whatever you want to call those things.
That, I have them, too.
I know. Don't we all? In any event, we came from the Jews of Sing Sing, which was probably one of the first books that were authored on criminal history, and especially for Jews. But you've taken it quite a bit further, I guess, in the new book. You want to give us a little overview?
Thanks, Susan. I thought I would, quote-unquote, share the love and help other people research their criminal ancestors. And given that I have some experience or had experience in not only New York criminal records, but also similar records from Illinois and California, I thought I would come up with a reference guide to help other people understand where they can find records about their black sheep.
Well, you know, in being, you know, involved in genealogy for all these many years, and I think my guest last week corrected my 27 years. It's I kind of maybe quit counting. It's more like 30, I think. In any event, you know, a lot of people, find that they have these history things and not sure whether they really want to delve into it or not delve into it. But what is the likelihood of someone having someone in their family, and I'm talking, you know, immediate or close to immediate family, in their family history?
I'll say the odds are pretty good. A research report came out last year from the Pew Research Center saying that 2.2 million adult Americans are incarcerated. So that's 1% of American adults. That does not include people who may have already been incarcerated but are out of jail today, or criminals who have never been convicted, much less thrown in jail. So they're probably double the 2.2 million number of criminals in the United States. So that's 4 to 5 million. That's a lot of people. So the odds are good. And if you go back generations and generations, the country's been around 200 plus years, odds are good in your family somewhere, there's probably a black sheep.
Well, I don't know if I have any of my family listening, but, you know, we were able to dig up some records, quite a long time ago, out of Chicago, but, there were just some stories that the family, had heard that, things just didn't make sense. And, you know, at the end of the day, the criminal records really explain why some of these stories don't make sense. Now, when you're talking about criminal records, I mean, I guess each state, and since what we're talking about are U.S. records, how far do some of the states go back?
There are certainly court records that go back probably to the 1700s. Prison records that I'm aware of certainly go back to the mid-1800s. So there are plenty of records across the country that go back 100, 150 years or more. So there are plenty of sets of records across the country going pretty far back.
So in this resource book that we're talking about, I mean, you have pretty much documented, I suppose, the types of records that are available state by state?
Yes. They fall into seven categories, although five of them make up the vast majority of the book. And the five most common categories are prison records, criminal court records, parole records, pardon records, and information about executions. But there are also investigative reports like those available from the FBI and police reports, which are, so I'm told, not as valuable as the other records I mentioned. But so there are seven categories of records which I talk about in the book, and they can be found across the country.
So, somebody might say, why in the world would I even want to know? Why would I want to know? I mean, I know why I wanted to know is because, I was researching my family and things didn't add up and I got stuck.
Well, the same thing happened to me. That's how and why I got involved. I would say I didn't choose to get involved, but I was researching my great-grandfather, and the first three records I came across about him showed that he was born in three different locations. He was born in New York, in London, and elsewhere in England, and that just didn't jive with the engineering part of me. I studied engineering in college, and I couldn't let that go. So I went looking for more records, and I stumbled upon a census record that showed that someone by the same name was behind bars at Sing Sing, and that just sort of blew my brains away. And the person listed behind bars at Sing Sing said that he was born in Pennsylvania, a fourth location. So this was consistently inconsistent. So it got to a point where I knew something was going on, and I pursued it further, and that led to my uncovering more about my great-grandfather, the Sing Sing inmate. But to answer your question more generically, they're colorful. Since there are these wonderful records about criminals, you can find a lot about their lives, and they're full of mystery, and I will argue it's also a challenge. The fact that you said that you ran into things that didn't add up, I ran into things that didn't add up. It's a more exciting puzzle, and if you really pursue it, it's going to be a fun time, and when you really solve the puzzle, it is a great sense of satisfaction.
It is, and Ron, I think maybe since we last spoke, I've been taking on pretty much a large caseload of research for other people. And I do run in from time to time, and more so than not, believe it or not, into cases where the mysteries are truly what are causing the roadblocks for most of my clients. And it is, you know, the digging through and you know, looking into these kinds of records that usually are necessary. And you said it, I said it. Now, you know, in a lot of the cases that I work on, it's usually when the records don't make sense or you can't find people where you think they're supposed to be, the likelihood of it being something to do with some criminal activity is probably 90 to 10. So I think, you know, I'm real excited about, you know, what you've done, because I think that for the genealogical community, it should be a terrific resource to really look for to, you know, help with those brick walls, because most of them, like I said, are really have to do with some sort of criminal activity. I mean, we joke about it, Ron, and I mean, you and I don't have ancestors that, you know, were running around, you know, the United States in the early 1800s. But, you know, the joke is, you know, the horse thieves in the family. And I've actually had a few cases where we've had a few. But, you know, it's, you know, for early American and you know, history and genealogy for people who do have family that were here during the early 1800s and mid to late 1800s, it's got to be a godsend, because that's probably where you're going to find them. Later on, you know, it gets a little different, but yeah, the records do open up some very interesting stories.
It's a gold mine, and some of the records are fabulous. For example, there are what are called biographical registers for the New York State Reformatory at Elmira, and they not only have pictures of these very young men, they may even have been teenagers, but also they list the family members. So they're chock full of information. And typically, prison records will also have a rap sheet, so you'll find not only what happened for that particular incident that put them behind bars in that day and time, but you'll find out what else they did beforehand and very possibly afterwards. And some of the big-name gangsters I researched for my first book, they had incredibly long rap sheets on one particular prison record. So they're incredibly rich, and they're just a lot of fun to play with.
They are. They really are. They do. They tell some tales that, you know, you. It really is fun stuff to read. You know, do you know, in doing some of this work, I mean, do you have some examples of stories that you know, would be interesting to any of us, just as an idea, just to kind of get a grip on, you know, what kinds of things one might find.
So I have some, over the years I've collected and looked at many different types of records, and I spent a fair amount of time in New York at many places, most notably the New York State Archives and also John Jay College of Criminal Justice and other places. So among the many things I found were one was a piece of paper showing how many amperes were used to electrocute people in Sing Sing's electric chair. So it really only takes one ampere to kill a person, but when they used the electric chair at Sing Sing, they were not messing around. They used 10 or 11 amperes, according to the document that I saw for three people. Whom I was researching. So when they fried in the electric chair, they really did fry. The smoke would come out of their head because there was a lot of electricity put through their bodies. That's just one example. I looked at the Alcatraz case file for another famous criminal, Mickey Cohen, who was the right-hand man for Bugsy Siegel. And he spent time not only in Alcatraz, but at the U.S. Federal Penitentiary in Atlanta, where he was hit over the head with an iron rod by a fellow inmate, breaking his skull. So they implanted in his head a steel plate to keep his head and brain stable. And in his file, there is an x-ray of his brain, and you see the metal plate. So this is not a normal record that you go looking for, but one of the many things I've found along the way.
And, you know, the other thing is name changes. I mean, you know, a lot of people that, you know, had criminal records end up changing their names, which makes it even that much more difficult to try to find someone.
One of the biggest challenges is the name change.
You know, I had a case just recently that was actually solved by DNA because the individual had changed their name, and he had done something and was running from the law, and came from Louisiana to Texas. And I mean, we had all the children's records. We could not locate this guy in any census records, but we could locate the wife and the children. And no matter what we did, I mean, he was just, you know, unavailable. We knew when he died, we had his tombstone. Anything between the time he got married and the time he died was absolutely empty. And it turned out that this guy did some had his DNA tested, and his DNA tested with a totally different family surname. And it turned out that the individual that he matched with 100% had the family Bible, and he had a family Bible. And it turns out that the guy with both surnames was in the same family Bible and born on the same day. And, you know, we actually got, you know, he actually really, solved this particular puzzle. It was just an incredible, thing. And, you know, the criminal records, we did not look at, and maybe I don't know if we would have found him. I think he was more running from the law than he was actually have been incarcerated or anything like that. So, you know, it is amazing how much of this exists in the genealogical field and across all races, religions, creeds, colors, you name it. It exists everywhere. So, going back to, you know, the work that you did to do this, you know, you started, I guess, with the New York thing and then just decided at that point just to start documenting it state by state by state.
That's correct. I went in alphabetical order. I think I started with Alabama, and I went from there. And I just did the whole country as well as federal records and the District of Columbia. And I do have in the front of the book, and something I'm willing to share right here, no charge, is just some methodology. We talked about understanding that criminals have multiple names. It's something that's very common. My great-grandfather had three different names, and it threw me for a loop. Not only was he born in four different locations, something Harry Houdini could not do, but he had three different names. So once you understand that you might be looking for multiple names, it's easier to play the game and try to unlock the mystery. And in looking at records, many, many, many records for Sing Sing, I just saw multiple aliases on a very high percentage of the admissions records. One person, I think, had 20 different aliases. So it's really hard, unless you get to these records and you understand what their aliases were, to research them.
So, for an audience and for anybody that's out there, and for me too, because, you know, I'm always game to learn more stuff, you know, where would one really start if they were, just this inkling that maybe there was something out there that they needed to look for in the area of, you know, for a criminal, or that if they're relative had a criminal record, where would one start?
The first place, whether it's the easiest or hardest, is to ask around in the family to see if anyone will open up and share that information with you. In my own family, I had 4 different responses, actually. My mother took this secret to her grave, so she didn't let on while I was around, or while she was around for me. I went to a cousin near me here in California, and he would never say a bad thing about anyone. So he had only nice things to say about my great-grandfather, the Sing Sing inmate. I had a 100-year-old cousin who had the response, "Oh, just let him rest in peace," so she did not help out. And then I found through my research process relatives living in England, and as soon as they knew what I was up to, I think they were hiding some more dirt. So where there's smoke, there's fire, and where there's resistance, there's dirt, in my humble opinion. So I really didn't get a whole lot of help from my family, but that is definitely the place to start. And families vary in how they deal with situations like this. Some families are quite open about it, and I actually collaborated with the grandson of a famous New York gangster by the name of Dopey Benny Fine, and the grandson was more than happy to share with me what he knew, and I share with him what I knew, and we collaborated on the chapter for my first book on his grandfather, Dopey Benny Fine. So family is definitely the first place to start. The second really major place to go looking for information are in newspapers, and fortunately there are plenty of them to go around. You can find newspapers on Ancestry.com. ProQuest has the New York Times, the LA Times, other major U.S. papers, which you can probably see at your local library. There are other websites, including Chronicling America, which is from the Library of Congress, NewspaperArchive.com, NewsBank.com. Your local library may have newspapers on microfilm. I know that's true at UC Berkeley near me here in Northern California. So newspapers are definitely a place to look for information, especially if your family's not going to open up. And once you can narrow down a place and a time, then you can go looking for some of these other records that I talk about and show in my book. But the first place really is the family. Second place, which is usually pretty easy, is a newspaper article.
Yeah, and you hit on something I think really important. I know in my family, you know, when I started questioning some of the movement, that I got absolutely no answer. And they're either stories that are passed down about something, or it is total silence and nobody wants to talk about it. I mean, that's really what I have seen. And usually, you know, when it gets to one of those extremes, whether you have a story that somebody is relayed to you, it's worth following, of course. And if they get silent, that's probably one of the biggest clues.
I'd like to actually go back and answer your earlier question a different way. Why would someone want to go into this type of research? And I will argue, for me, it was extended psychotherapy. By understanding my great-grandfather Krimmel's life, it actually explains events of my childhood, even though he was dead long before I was born. There are things that happened in my grandparents' house, and I write about this in my first book, that can be explained only by knowing that my great-grandfather did what he did. So there were words that were used that didn't make sense until I understood other characters my great-grandfather was dealing with. And the other story that I talk about is one day I went to my great-grandmother and asked her, what would happen if I was a bad boy today? And I told her I thought you'd have to throw me away in Sing Sing. When she heard that, she got very upset. She said, "Don't you use the word Sing Sing in front of your grandfather. That will upset him greatly." And I just thought, why would she say that? But when I was doing my research, this story popped into my brain as if it happened just yesterday. And I thought, there must be a reason why Grandma said that to me. And sure enough, my great-grandfather was in Sing Sing. So it all made sense, and it explains events of my childhood. So it's very personal and very powerful, and I can't emphasize how wonderful this is to have been able to figure this stuff out.
Really what you're saying, and I think that this is part of where the whole topic of my radio show is, where genealogy and spirit connect, is that the healing that comes from understanding, accepting fact, forgiving, I guess is a part of it, is really part of a healing process that genealogy really imparts among people. I can't tell you from my own perspective, and I know you just mentioned it, Ron, that, you know, it's a closure, and it allows both you and the members of your family to accept the fact and be able to move on with their lives, you know, without that pondering and that, you know, what was it? And, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm the type of person that as long as I know what I'm dealing with, I can deal with it. It is the not knowing that's very hard for me to deal with.
I agree, Susan. I wish my mother had told me this. It would save me 10 years of my life writing the first book. So a little angry, a little happy that my mother didn't tell me, but I know.
Well, you know, things don't always work out for a reason, Ron. If she had told you, you'd have never done what you did.
That lesson, so yes, I agree.
Yeah, that's part of the synchronicity of life, I think, is that we are spared some things so that we can learn it for ourselves, and in so doing, we can build and help other people, and that's what you've done, and that's what I think is so interesting about life. I mean, you know, yes, it took 10 years, but look at what you've done and where you've come.
I'm very pleased. Thank you, Mom.
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
But I think other people can benefit the same way. There's just so much you can learn about researching these black sheep characters in depth that may have a very personal impact.
It can. I mean, there are hundreds of things. I mean, you know, I had Steve Luxenberg on my show, too, back in August, I think. And he had written his book about, his mother's sister that nobody in the family knew she even had. And it was a touching story. It's called Annie's Ghost. And there's an archive available both on bbsradio.com and my website. But, you know, here's a person that was, an editor at Washington Post. And genealogy is, the subject matter of his book. So, genealogy can change one's life in many, many ways. Who would have thought years ago that I would be doing a radio show and all the things that I've done? So, don't put it in the back burner, because there are a lot of things that one can come up with when one starts doing research. And as you research, as Ron has done, you become an expert on a subject, and as the expert on the subject, you have lots to write about and lots to talk about and lots to educate people about. So that's been, it really is amazing how these things and these events in our lives, pretty much change the way and change our whole direction and where we go. I mean, your background, Ron, was not in genealogy by any stretch of the imagination, reading your bio.
Far from it. I was in marketing in the high-tech world, and this is, I was never a writer. I was more analytical person working on high-tech products. So I've come very far afield, and also I was never comfortable talking before large audiences. And once I gave a talk at a major conference in London, 90 people in the audience, and they fell out of the chair laughing hysterically at my wild story about my great-grandfather. It truly changed my life. So now I'm going to get rid of the phone call.
There you go. Maybe it's somebody wanting to buy your book.
I can't buy it fast enough. Let those phone calls ring. Let the orders pour in.
Yeah. Now, people can get your book at off your website, which is ronarons.com, right?
Correct. They must be calling for the book. They just heard you. They're calling in to order it.
There you go. I didn't give out your phone number. But I will give out the phone number if you want to call in and ask Ron any questions. If you think you've got some criminal history or you're stuck or whatever, that number is 888-815-9756.
In the meantime, I think I'm willing to share other helpful hints in researching criminals, if you like that, Susan.
That's where we were going to go next.
Okay. So, I don't want to say once a criminal, always a criminal, but yeah, one has to understand if you commit a crime once, it's possible, if not probable, that you'll commit a crime again, and it's very common to see that criminals commit multiple crimes, so, and they may not be in the same location. People moved around. They tried to evade the law, so they might commit crimes in multiple states. A perfect example, as one of my favorite characters in my first book, Irving Wexler, he worked in Philadelphia, New Jersey, New York, Boston, and he wound up spending time. He's the only criminal, Jewish or other, that I'm aware of who spent time in Sing Sing, Leavenworth, and Alcatraz, as well as U.S. Federal Penitentiary in Atlanta, Attica Prison in New York, Auburn Prison. He was everywhere. How he got his job done being incarcerated so much of the time, I have yet to figure out. But criminals commit multiple crimes. So you have to understand that. So you have to understand that records for a particular location may not be found necessarily in that state. Federal records are the best example, where federal records are held at regional archives, at the National Archives in different locations. So it's very conceivable that for any particular state where a crime may have been committed, the record for that may be in one of three different locations, or three different states. So the records may not be where you expect them to be. Records have privacy restrictions, so you may not be able to get your hands on some of these records for a long time. That was certainly true of the Mickey Cohen Alcatraz file. There was a long wait for that, and three people worked at Alcatraz Island and myself were requesting that this file be opened up to public access, and I was lucky enough to be the first one to take a look at it. It wound up being 7,000 pages, and it's a whale of a file and a lot of stuff, but it took time to get that vetted by someone at the National Archives before it was available for public access. And I'll give another example. I went looking for what's called an alien file for another criminal, and I filed a Freedom of Information Act, and it took 2 years to get the file.
Oh, boy.
I do have to say it was worth waiting 2 years because the resultant file was 5,500 pages long, and it had juicy details galore, including his girlfriend's names and all sorts of great stuff.
So, I want to interrupt you for a second. I mean, do you have to pay for these 5,500 pages copies, or how does that work?
I was given two choices. I could either pay by the page in hard copy form or pay maybe $20, $25 for a CD with the whole thing in a large PDF file. So I said, I'll take the CD. I'll save some trees and save some money at the same time.
Go green. Go green.
Go green. And the same is true. The FBI will charge you X amount of money per page, or you can get it on CD as well. So there, it depends on how big the file is. And with the FBI, the first couple hundred pages are free, and then you have to pay for more than that.
Okay.
So the records vary in how much they will cost you.
And if you have a big criminal that has a lot of history and background, it could get expensive.
Could get a little expensive. I do have to say the vast majority of records in the book that I talk about are in hard copy format. They have not been scanned in, much less index, so you really have to go to places to look at these records. There are volumes and volumes and multiple sets of records across the country, and you have to go to physical locations to see the vast majority of these records. So that will cost you some money too. So it is an expense, but these records are incredibly rich and argue quite worth the effort.
Well, you know, my family member who the records I found in Chicago, I had to go to the courthouse, obviously, and I remember paying a pretty penny at that time, and we're going back about, you know, 15 years maybe, for copies of it, and they were on microfilm, actually, I think. And, you know, it's about an inch thick, And this was not a big major crime by any stretch of the imagination. It was, you know, a white collar kind of deal. But, you know, I remember I paid pretty good for those copies.
Some of these records themselves are just fun to see. The Sing Sing admissions records in the 1930s and 1940s, for example, are these huge binders and probably 100 to 200, maybe more than that, admissions records per binder. And they're heavy. They're about 30 to 40 pounds a piece. They're just unwieldy. It's just physically impossible to take photocopies of these records. It's just really hard. They're huge and heavy, unwieldy. So I got started working with these records just at the advent of digital photography, and I took a 4-megapixel camera, a dinosaur by today's standards, but state-of-the-art at the time, and I took 7,000-plus photographs of Sing Sing admissions registers.
Oh, my goodness.
For the research for my first book. So that's another consideration when doing this work is that some of these records may be in bad shape, so you should consider using a digital camera if the repository you're going to allows that. Some will, some won't.
Right. And no flash.
No flash. Save the paper, which is disintegrating before your eyes.
Right. Right. You know, I mean, I come to do that these days myself when I go to, do library work. I take a digital camera, turn off the flash, find myself a nice lit area, and, you know, just shoot the pages that I need.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than get, copies from the books or the microfilm. And some of the books, as stated, you can't even put in a copy machine sometimes. So, you know, it's the digital world is definitely changing the whole complexion of doing research, and it's changing dramatically every day, I think. Very exciting. I mean, the things that, you know, like you say, I mean, you have to physically go and do these things. I mean, there was a time, Ron, when we had to do that for everything that we were doing in genealogy. I mean, we had to go to the courthouses, and we had to literally go through the courthouse books and, you know, the registers and things like that. And, you know, a lot of that stuff is being digitized and now available online, and some and the sources that you've given, and, you know, others such as footnote.com and, New England Historical Society, and you name it. It's our world has changed, so it is kind of exciting where things have gone. It's now whether, you know, trying to figure out where you go to find something, and I think that's probably the hardest part in genealogy today. It's not so much where the records, it's not so much, you know, getting the records, it's just finding out where they are and whether or not you can get a hold of them online, or whether you can get a hold of them, you know, in a library, or whether you have, or from the family history library, or in some cases, as you say, you have to physically still go.
Unfortunately, these criminal records are one of the last bastions of genealogical records that really have not been scanned and indexed and made available online, so you really have to work a little bit extra, and I'll reiterate, I believe it's worth the effort because they are so rich. And given that these people are a little bit challenging to research, if you can get your hands on one or more documents about an individual, it really will lead you in multiple different directions, and it'll really help solve the puzzle.
And, you know, as well as I do, that it's the clues that kind of lead you in directions. And usually when you're stumped, and, you know, these records, obviously, as I found out in the one record, you know, that I got, it opened up some clues and some doors, and, you know, you can sometimes just shoot right through and get to where you need to go. Whereas without, you know, touching it or staying away from it, and you won't get there. And that goes back to, I think, some of the things that you talked about, Ron, about, do we really want to know, and why do we want to know, and, you know, the importance of, really, if you're going to document your family history, you need to document your family history, the good, the bad, the ugly.
It's just too easy to look at the Nobel laureates in the family and just ignore the bad stuff, but it's really part of your past, and I choose to accept it and embrace it and cherish it.
You have to. I mean, you know, those who have some criminals, it's very colorful. And, people say that genealogy is boring and dry and whatever, and it's far from it, and especially if you have a little bit of extra color in the family, and that's...
Not these people, that's for sure, and it's not not limited to men either. There are plenty of records about female criminals as well. Certainly at the New York State Archives, there are records for prisons designed for women. At the New York Public Library, in the Special Collections Department, there is a set of 3x5 cards about people who showed up at night court in the 19-teens on charges of prostitution. There are many records about men and women, so the women are not off the hook here. They committed crimes too, whether they were intentional or they just got hooked into it by someone else.
You know, and some of the FBI files that I think you mentioned early in the show, some of those are on footnote.com. And I will tell you, I got hung up one day looking for something and ended up in some of these FBI files and probably spent 2 or 3 hours reading things that had absolutely nothing to do with what I was working on. But I was just fascinated with the topics and the subjects. And, sometimes it just gets really interesting and you just can't put it down. I mean, sometimes it's better than novels. I mean, you know, this is real life novel stuff, novel material, really.
Sometimes it gets more interesting for another reason, Susan, the fact that the FBI records are often redacted, so you'll see large blocks of black or white where things have been erased to protect the quote-unquote innocent. So not unless you really, really, really research a person in depth and know their associates, would you be able to make out what might be going on the parts that have been blacked or whited out. So they get even more interesting and more challenging because of the intent to protect the quote-unquote innocent.
It really is. It's you must be having a ball doing this. I mean, I could see where this could be pretty a lot of fun.
Well, it's definitely intellectually stimulated, and they are among the more difficult genealogical problems to solve. So I do take it on as a challenge, and I do enjoy it. Some people like Sudoku. I like researching criminals. They are fun. Some people go to visit different baseball stadiums across the United States. I go visit prisons across the United States. So that's my craziness. And due to my stature or my experience, I've had some incredible fortune opportunities. I gave a lecture here in Northern California, and a woman came up to me and she said, I grew up in the house where Bugsy Siegel was shot to death. So she gave me the name of the new owner of the house, and I called him up, and he was nice enough to open up his house to me in Los Angeles, and I saw the house where Bugsy Siegel was shot to death, and it's this beautiful house with stained glass windows and a circular staircase, and it just was a thrill to be able to see this historic house where a famous gangster was shot to death and was very much a part of the movie Bugsy. So it really was like the movie.
Do they have any ghosts?
I didn't hang around long enough to answer that question. And I was smart enough not to bring my camera and take pictures. He said, you're not going to take pictures. So I always said, no, I really thought that would be tacky. And the person who owned the house was very pleased I did not bring a camera. Yeah. But it was a gorgeous house, and I was very happy to have the privilege and honor to see that house inside and out.
Well, if my recollection serves me correct, and I hope that my family's not listening, is that there is some in-laws that have direct lineage to Bugsy Siegel.
Really now?
Yes, in Chicago.
Uh-oh.
I know who they are, but they're related to me via in-laws, like, yeah. So it's not a direct relation, but it's a, you know, it's a member of the family, extended family. So
maybe you're related to another person who I met, and this goes to the other benefits of doing this type of research, is that you do help other people. So years ago, you may or may not remember this, Susan, but I gave a talk about Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky at a conference in Las Vegas.
Right.
And in order to prepare for that presentation, I was taking a class in Los Angeles on gangsters, and the instructor asked people in the audience to introduce themselves, and this woman said, I happen to be the niece of Bugsy Siegel, and I nearly dropped my pants, and I just lost control. And, like, I have to talk to this woman.
Yeah.
And so I met with her, and I showed her a very preliminary version of my presentation about Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky. And she said, I didn't know that. I couldn't even go see the movie Bugsy until my father passed away. So I taught her a lot about Bugsy Siegel, which was also a thrill, and she told me what she knew about her uncle. So it's very collaborative, and to her, she got more closure by what I told her about her famous uncle. So it's a lot of fun, not only for personal reasons, but to help others and get their view on the world.
Yeah, it's possible. I was sitting here while you were telling that story, while I was listening to it, which I'm not a multitasker that much anymore. trying to figure out what the relationship was, and it was this individual's mother who was the sister of Bugsy Siegel, so that would have made her the niece. A niece.
We'll take this offline and maybe...
there you go.
Same person.
It might very well be.
Very interesting. It's a very small world.
It is. I mean, it is. And, you know, I know that on Facebook we follow each other and you know, we're all watching this current day saga unfold with Madoff. And,
I know about him, too. I have proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that I have connections to him via 2 or 3 degrees of separation, at least 6 different ways.
Really?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not 1 degree of separation. I didn't give him any of my money, but I have proven, and I talk about this in another talk of mine, how through high school friends, through other colleagues, I am connected to Bernie multiple different ways. And it's just most amusing how small this world is.
It is. It really is. I mean, you know, I mean, I see these degrees of separation things popping up all over the place. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, going back to my theory, I mean, we all come from the same source. And, you know, we all go back pretty much to, you know, the same originating factor. And you know, we really all do have, you know, similarities, and we all do have criminals in our past.
We've come full circle to answer your first question all over again. It's very likely somehow you are related to some criminal.
Yep, I think everybody would be. Even if you don't think you are, you probably are.
Somehow you're related.
Yep. Well, I think the concept is phenomenal, and I applaud you on your effort to you know, really put together something that will have some value for the genealogists today and you know, in the future. I just think that, you know, these ancillary parts, I mean, you know, we can go through census records and we can go pull death records and we can go pull, you know, birth records and we can pull all your standard records that one would normally pull. And probably the one type of record that we don't even think to go to would be the criminal records, and especially when we begin not to find things in the normal course of genealogy research. It's it really is a place that is of vital importance, I think, to anyone. I mean, I know I've had like I said, several cases, and one I think in particular. Probably the book might have been very helpful in guiding us to where maybe we needed to go for some records. So I think it's great. Now, what's next on your agenda, Ron?
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. I have many other books in me. I don't know if I'll give out all those details today, but I have plenty of projects. People have suggested I do a book about Jewish criminals on the West Coast, which is in the realm of possibilities. I'll be talking about that at the IAJGS, International Jewish Genealogy Conference in Los Angeles this summer, so I'm working that up. I don't know if there's enough material for a book, but I have other projects in mind. Largely to do with criminals or criminal-like behavior. So this is my bailiwick. I didn't choose this, but I've, through no motivation on my own, become an expert on criminals. So
I think it's wonderful.
It's a unique niche in the market.
There you go. And, you know, in today's world, I mean, the niche is...
have to have a niche.
You do have to have one.
This is my crazy niche.
So anything else I haven't asked?
Let's see.
Since you and I go back so long, I'm not proud.
I just reiterate that you can get so much out of it. I'll give some more tips if I can find them in my book very quickly of what to consider.
Well, let's do that. We got some minutes left here, and let's get as much as we can.
I will argue that some repositories don't even know what they have. And in some cases, I've had to show some repositories where records, that they should have certain records if they don't have them, where to find the records. Case in point is that another criminal that I researched, his name was Irving Wexler. He died in Alcatraz, but for some reason he was not on, and still remains, not on the list of inmates at Alcatraz. Well, I have had, and still have, his California death certificate, which shows he died in Alcatraz. I have the New York Times article saying he died in Alcatraz, but the people at the National Archives said, well, if he's not on the list, he could not have possibly spent one day in Alcatraz. So even though I showed them these two documents, the New York Times article and a death certificate from the state of California, they didn't believe that this criminal died in Alcatraz. Okay. Fortunately, I spoke to someone else at another National Archives branch who said, oh, there's another set of records called the Notorious Offender Series, and they are at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. So I got that file and made a copy, and now that's in my local National Archives facility to be an augmentation to the Alcatraz inmate case file list.
Okay.
So it's just a case in point or an example that even if someone tells you something might not be there in their repository, maybe it should be there, and maybe it's elsewhere. So don't give up is the moral of the lesson.
Right. So, I mean, really, this book is a great start as a finding aid, and I would venture to say you're going to be updating it ongoing.
I think I'm going to do that. I'm going to hear. I've already heard about things that could be added, and I've made some minor adjustments to some very minor mistakes, but it will be constantly updated, I have a feeling.
Well, you may have hit on something. I mean, this is, and like you said, I mean, a lot of repositories really do not know what they have. And there is such a wealth of information and documentation from the past. It really is an incredible process, to be able to go back and find records, dated back to the early settlers of the United States, and then even back in Europe and Eastern Europe, the 1300s. I mean, the records exist. It's just a matter of finding them, which is really part of the fun of doing the kind of work that we do. And then having people like you who put them into finding aids so that, we have a basis on where to start.
There's a lot to be found, and you just have to be interested in going after it. It's there for the taking.
So, anybody out there that wants to get into researching their criminal family members past. Wonderful resource that Ron Ahrens has put together for us. And, but not to forget the book on the Jews of Sing Sing that we discussed back in June, but, an overview. Why don't you give us a quick overview so that when they go to your site, they have an opportunity to look at both.
Thank you for the question, Susan. So I'll actually position the two books against each other. The second book, Wanted U.S. Criminal Records, shows you where to find the records. And in my first book, The Jews of Sing Sing, I definitely document not only my great-grandfather's life, but also the lives of about a dozen other criminals who served time in Sing Sing. And I'll argue that it's very complementary to the second book. The Jews of Sing Sing is sort of a template that shows you how to piece the pieces together of the puzzle once you find them. So the first book actually shows you how to piece things together. The second book shows you where to find the pieces. So they are very complementary books to each other. And they're fun in their own right, but I think they're that much more powerful together.
Well, I think it's really phenomenal what you've done, Ron. I'm really tickled. I've known you for quite a while. And I think long before you even got into being a writer and an author, and I think I remember being at that seminar when you did that first presentation and how everybody kind of laughed and, and look at what's happened. It's pretty phenomenal.
Who knew this would have taken place?
I know.
Who knew?
I tell you, it's a great life we live, because if you take advantage of opportunities, good or bad, really the whole world is your oyster. It's an incredible concept.
I'm just trying to share the love and let other people have similar wonderful experiences.
Well, I think everybody will, and I really thank you again for coming back on the show, and thanks for sharing the information that you've really spent a great deal of time and effort and energy over many years, I know, to put together and make available. You can find Ron at his website, ronarons.com. You can buy both of his books from his website. And, hope everybody will think again about putting those criminal family members aside and deciding not to deal with them and to go ahead and deal with them and get everything out in the open. And you may be surprised at the healing that might take place for you and your family and possibly future generations by having things right there out in the open. In any event, I'm Susan King. You can find me at www.susaneking.com. We have some more exciting guests coming up over the next several weeks, and we'll be sharing a lot more information on a lot of different subjects in the field of genealogy and spirituality as the weeks and months progress. And you never know where we might be coming from. Good day, and we will talk to you next week.
You have been listening to Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect with Susan E. King. Each week we will focus on the spiritual journey of connecting ourselves with our ancestors. Join us every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. For upcoming show information, you can visit Susan's website at www.susaneking.com.